Wisconsin has given the country and the world some incredible scholars and scientists. And today we're going to learn about one of the more fascinating characters, researchers and scientists, Increase Lapham. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. There's a wonderful new biography out about Increase Lapham, and the two authors are joining us today from our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Milwaukee. After her retirement from teaching English at Milwaukee Area Technical College, Martha Berglund took a short break from fiction to write an article on Lapham for Milwaukee Magazine. Well, now that little break took about 5 years of study, or became 5 years of studying, I guess we should say, Increase Lapham. She is the co-author of Studying Wisconsin, The Life of Increase Lapham, early chronicler of plants, rocks, rivers, mounds, and all things Wisconsin. Martha, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Paul Hayes was longtime science reporter for the Milwaukee Journal, often relied on the work of Increase Lapham. He retired in 1995, but continued to write, often referring to Lapham and his contributions. And he is the co-author of Studying Wisconsin. And Paul, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
Great to have you both with us. And as you listen to our two guests, you can join in as well. Have you heard of Increase Lapham? Are you aware of his contributions to our state? Do you think as a society we've lost something, maybe with the specialization that is now sort of the norm in science and beyond? Join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Martha, maybe I'll turn to you first. Increase Lapham was born in 1811. What was the United States like then? Remind us about that.
In 1811, it was a very different place from what it is now. And one of the things that had just begun to happen was some of the great building projects. The Erie Canal had not quite been conceived of, but it was the Erie Canal right after that that really changed a great deal of this country, actually changed the size of this country, because it allowed for the Western expansion, not only of goods, but of people. So many people began to travel west, and as they traveled west, of course, we occupied more and more land, and the country got bigger and bigger and bigger.
And just grew, yeah.
Yeah.
He was born into a very strong Quaker family. How did that shape him and his education?
Well, the Quakers were noted and for being interested in the natural world, and they held, apparently, curiosity as a virtue. And he was encouraged by his Quaker parents to study on his own, to observe, and his whole family, they would do these kinds of things together. So they would gather specimens. They would they had a kind of family cabinet of curiosities. They explored together. They would go into the woods and gather spring plants. They would look for the first flowering of particular plants. They gathered fossil specimens. They went to explore springs. There was one story about the brothers and the father and some other men capping up a spring to see what would happen when it was sealed up. Would it explode? Could you burn off the gas? It sounds like such a boy thing to do, but they enjoyed all these sort of quasi-scientific experiments that were actually a lot like play, I think.
Well, I know the men in his family had a tradition of working on canal building, and maybe you could talk about the significance a bit of the Erie Canal.
Well, the Erie Canal was really his first school. It was the canal engineers, the canal workers, not the laborers so much, but the men who were the professional contractors. These people were the the sort of school teachers that that Increase studied with. He had very little schooling, but he had a great education. These were people on the canal who read, who were curious, who passed information around up and down the canals. And so the Erie Canal, it's great public enterprise. It's also its great destruction of the environment around it. Both of these things, I think, had a big influence on Increase Lapham. He saw the value of people cooperating, and when they cooperated, they could build amazing things, but they were also, at the same time, destroying the beautiful natural world that he loved.
Yeah. Well, maybe, Paul, I'll turn to you for just a minute.
Okay.
What brought Increase Lapham to Wisconsin in 1836?
Well, he was still working in canals in Kentucky and Ohio in the early 1830s, and in Ohio he became an employee of the state Canal Commission, and in that office he worked with Byron Kilbourn. Byron Kilbourn later was came to Wisconsin with the backing of an Ohio financier to do surveying, but with a special mission to look at the west side of Lake Michigan as a site for a city, and Kilbourn settled on Milwaukee Harbor for that. Kilbourn immediately began in land speculating, and he also developed the idea of a canal between Lake Michigan and the Rock River, and he knew that Increase was reliable and smart, and so he sent to Ohio for Increase to come to Wisconsin. Increase struggled with that for a little bit because he knew it would take him away from his family, but later he decided to come to Wisconsin, and he came here in 1836 just as the Wisconsin Territory was formed out of the Michigan Territory. So he was in on the beginning of an area called Wisconsin, and he was right at the, for the first time in his life, right at the very frontier of the United States in its westward movement.
Yeah, Wisconsin was really part of that western frontier.
It was. It was a blank slate for a young naturalist like Increase. And he was the right man, and he had arrived at the right place for his interests and for what he wanted to do.
Yeah, absolutely. What an interesting guy. Gosh, yeah. Wouldn't it be fun to have a chance to sit down with him for a cup of coffee and talk?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness me. The stories that he could tell, the things that he did. Oh. He wrote a guide to the Wisconsin Territory, which actually I think wasn't it the first book published here?
First commercial book published in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
It was published in Milwaukee. As a matter of fact, when he began it in the 1830s, Wisconsin didn't have a capacity to publish it. But while he was still working on it, P.C. Hale opened a book bindery and a printing shop in Milwaukee, and had the competence to publish a book. So when he delivered his manuscript in 1844, Hale published it, and it became the first major book, the first commercial book published here. Let me see if I can find the in the book. I want to read from the title page. Here it comes. A geographical and topographical description of Wisconsin with brief sketches of its history, geology, mineralogy, natural history, population, soil, productions, government, antiquities, etc., etc., by I.A. Lapham, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. published by P.C. Hale, 1844.
Oh, that's great.
Nobody could have done that but Increase.
Oh, man. And who, Martha, who was the intended audience?
Well, his intended audience was prospective settlers in the state. So it was a guidebook for perhaps for people who had already arrived, but it was also used to recruit people for Wisconsin. And actually, it did a pretty good job. And in 1846, an enlarged edition was published, and it sold very well. As a matter of fact, it sold so well that it was ripped off and by a publisher in, I think, New York, who just claimed it as his own and reprinted it and sold it, and Increase didn't see a dime of that. But so it was a very popular book at the time and a very useful book. And that's what I think is so interesting about Lapham, is we think of him as a scientist who we think sometimes particularly early science as being not necessarily that useful, but Increase was very conscious of how he wanted all of his science to be useful to the citizens.
It's a really, really fascinating guy and a fascinating book. Our guests today, Martha Berglund and Paul Hayes, are the co-authors of Studying Wisconsin, The Life of Increase Lapham. A generalist in terms of his science, but very meticulous guy, and a fascinating personality. You can join in. Maybe you have questions about him, or maybe about the life, the times that he lived in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page, at the Larry Mueller Show. And I think sort of, Mark has a Facebook question that I think is really worth it to pass on right now. A good question. Or he says, my favorite state park is Lapham Peak. And I ran a 10K there last year. How did that particular park end up being named after Increase Lapham?
Well, actually, the present Lapham Peak in Waukesha County was named after the turn of the 20th century in Lapham's honor, and it was the second Lapham Peak. The first Lapham Peak was in the Kettle Moraine, but it was in Washington County. He went out to the highest hill, Glacial Hill, in Washington County because there were three Indian mounds on the top of it, and he was doing work on his antiquities, and he was also doing on-site geology, and the neighbors were so honored to have him there that they named the place Lapham Peak. Later, that hill became known as Holy Hill. When the church was built, and the name Lapham Peak was applied to a large came, which is a glacial formation in Waukesha County, that had been named Government Hill, and they thought that it was a proper site for Lapham Peak because Government Hill also contained weather measuring apparatus, and of course Lapham was one of the founders of the U.S. Weather Bureau, and so it's a very appropriate title for it.
Oh man, that guy did amazing, amazing things, and we're going to talk some more about Increase Lapham with our guests Martha Berglund and Paul Hayes. I'm Larry Mueller. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Now we're learning about the fascinating life and career of a man of science, Increase Lapham, with the authors of a fascinating book, co-authors, again, Martha Berglund and Paul Hayes. The book is titled Studying Wisconsin, The Life of Increase Lapham. It's a wonderful book. And certainly join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You know, he was obviously very fascinated by botany. How did he go about collecting and categorizing the flora of Wisconsin? And go ahead, Martha.
Increase had been collecting plant specimens in Kentucky and Ohio and had gotten pretty good at collecting and preserving specimens. And he continued that practice and got better and better at it. And he had to know a lot in order to be able to do that. He had to know when a plant was flowering or when it was seeding, where it would grow, in what climate or microclimate. So he had to know when and where to collect plants. He had to know how to not collect too much so that small plant communities would not be destroyed. And then he had to carry them home in such a way in his vasculum so that they would not dry out, but they would dry out just wilt just enough so that he could then arrange them on drying paper. And he arranged them in very useful, informative, and artistic ways. So he would arrange them on the drying paper, press them, dry them, make sure they weren't getting eaten by bugs, make sure that they did not mold, and then he would mount them on very expensive sheets of paper, and then he dispersed. He didn't just keep all this stuff. He sent it off all over the country so that he was corresponding with botanists all over the country, and particularly Asa Gray in the East, Charles Short in Kentucky, and he sent plants to the East that later went on to Kew Gardens and to German collections, so that his plant specimens were widely distributed and were also very well appreciated for their informative beauty. They were very beautiful plant specimens. He was complimented frequently for the quality of his plant specimens.
Amazing guy. Brian in Iola has a question. Hi, Brian. Thank you very much for calling.
Oh, thanks for having me answering my call. I've been an Increase Lapham fan for a long time. In fact, I studied Antiquities of Wisconsin back in the 70s and went out looking for mounds and things. But I was under the impression that he collected weather data, you know, a lot of continuity over many years. And I also thought I had heard that when he was off, you know, studying things, that his wife continued to collect his, you know, meteorological readings on site.
Yeah, that's in his correspondence. When he was out doing work on the mounds, he would write his wife, Ann, in Milwaukee to make sure that she took the measurements that from the instruments he had set up on the banks of the Milwaukee River just east of their home in downtown Milwaukee. And so either she or the boys, Henry or Seneca, would go down to a little weather station that was set up on the west bank of the Milwaukee. He began to keep meteorological data about Wisconsin from the very time he arrived in 1836 throughout his life. And he became, as I said earlier, one of the founders of the U.S. Weather Bureau, or what became the U.S. Weather Bureau.
Yeah, the Signal Corps, right?
Yeah, U.S. Signal Corps Storm Warning System.
Mm-hmm. Well, and actually I used to teach about that in my science classes.
Good for you.
Another step would be, you know, while those readings are being taken, because I used to be a weather observer, if one was to go, you know, to the Historical Society, I was wondering, you know, or is there anywhere where those readings are recorded, and would they actually be in the handwriting, you know, and initialed perhaps by his wife or sons? You know what I mean about a data collection?
The Historical Society has 27 boxes of Lapham material. Much of it is lists, and much of it is the published recordings of his weather data.
Yeah, that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
I think you would find, if not, you would find some data recorded, certainly in his handwriting, probably in Anne's as well.
Oh, that's...
Yeah.
You know how, if you've looked at old data, you know.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
To see the writing.
The handwriting is wonderful.
It's
yeah.
thrilling.
And luckily he had really legible handwriting because we had to read a lot of it.
Well, that's, you know, I've kind of been wondering that for a long time, and now I have, I'll probably go down there and look.
Oh, good.
You know, I know I'll have to sign a form and look through
a box. Oh, sure.
Sure,
yeah.
But if you look through a box, you'll have done 1/27th of your work because of 27 boxes.
That's the one that's down near Marquette. Not in Marquette Park. Well, right there, you know, the triangle-shaped building.
Oh, that's the County Historical Society.
Oh, no, that's the County Historical Society. You want to go to the Wisconsin Historical Archives
in
Madison.
Yeah.
Oh, it's in Madison. Oh,
on the UW campus.
Yeah. You saved me a trip there.
Okay.
Well, okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Maybe you could talk more. He's really kind of considered the father of the National Weather Service. How did he get? What was the impetus there? How did he get it going?
He was interested in weather all of his life, but when he got to Milwaukee, he began to take note of the storms that would sneak up on the sailors and the boats on Lake Michigan with great loss in material and lives. And he felt that he had read the science work of a man named Espy, who had observed that weather in North America came from the west, and so if there was a way to communicate where a storm was to the east, you could do a prediction of when the storm would arrive at Lake Michigan and save lives. That was his major impetus. He had been interested in weather all of his life, but in this case. He thought it was very necessary to get a storm warning system up to save Great Lakes sailors, and he began to lobby for that. A lot of people were thinking about it at the same time, and so there was an effort led by Joseph Henry, the secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, to put together a network of weather observers throughout the United States. And they could communicate for the first time by using telegraph, which Henry had a hand in developing. So you could send out information in advance of the storm. And Lapham developed a close relationship with a fellow observer in Dubuque who determined that when a storm came through Dubuque, it would arrive in Milwaukee with certain variables between 6 to 8 hours later. And that would give them time to set up a signal that storms were coming and maybe the boats could make a run for harbors and anchor safely. So that was the big motive. The whole effort was interrupted severely by the Civil War, but it was resumed after the war, and by the 1870s there was a national network of weather observers. Lapham became an employee and worked out of Chicago, and he wrote and circulated the first official weather forecast in the United States.
Isn't that amazing? Ah, what a guy. At one point, you say that even at a young age, Lapham, I think your words were, needed scientific knowledge the way that his body needed meat and bread. And did that stay kind of true through his entire life?
Absolutely. I mean, we've frequently wondered how did he do all of this stuff because he was doing science all the time, as far as we can tell. What he must have done is just, in order to not tire himself out, just shift from one science to another. That is, from one area to another. He would do his meteorological gathering, and then he would go out and collect plants, and then while he was collecting plants, he would always notice the rocks, and so and the mounds, and so he could do a lot of things on the same trips in the same on the same days, but he never stopped doing that. And actually, on the day he died, he finished an article about the fishes in one of the lakes,
Lake Oconomowoc,
he had to do this. It was clearly not he didn't take breaks from it. When he went on trips, he was still looking at all the things he looked at here.
Was he received and thought of well by his contemporaries?
We think that upon his death, he was probably the most honored and respected man in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
He's always been remembered in some way. There's Lapham Peak, as we've already mentioned, but there's Lapham School in Madison. There's Lapham Hall at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. There are Lapham Boulevard and Lapham Avenue. Certain fossils have been named after Lapham. Certain flowers have been named after Lapham. So he was widely respected and honored in this way. The first article of the first issue of the Wisconsin Magazine of History was a short biography of Lapham, and that was in 1917. So it continued. We think interest has flagged in Lapham for a couple of reasons, and the major one probably is that the science that he was working in has become settled science. At the time, it was cutting-edge science, and it would have amazed the people he lectured to hear some of the theories of that he was dabbling in botany and geology. But now it's the stuff that you learn in primary and grades, yeah, and in museums, yeah, and in high school. So it's not astonishing anymore to read the science that he was working in. But he was one of the reasons that it has become settled science, especially in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
He was a very beloved figure when he died. And
what about personally? Was that, you know, he didn't beat his wife or...
No. No. I mean, we kind of, you know, you kind of look for flaws. You look to see, you know, is this guy real? But we didn't find any really major flaws. And he was a good man. He was a good citizen. He was a very conscientious man. He was a wonderful family man. And, I can't find anything, you know, really negative to say about him.
He was shy and he was modest.
Yeah.
In all things. But the thing that drove him, I think, more than anything was a sense of duty that must have come from his Quaker background. And he felt that all of the knowledge that he gathered was public knowledge, and he thought of it as public service. That's one of the reasons there's so much stuff at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He didn't throw anything away that had to do with science. And all of his correspondence is there with other scientists, his books, his manuscripts, his lists. It's all there, and it's protected. And part of the reason for that was his daughter Julia, after his death, transcribed much of his correspondence in 1,500 pages of typescript, which is also at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Yeah. We think he saved this stuff not for personal honor, but because he thought it was useful and valuable, and should belong to the people.
Oh, boy.
He was shy and modest, and he was also ambitious and very sure of himself. He was sure of his mind, and he was ambitious for using his mind to know as much as he could about the world around him. And not only knowing it, but he had to disseminate that knowledge. He had to write about it. We think of him as a scientist, but we wouldn't even know about him as a scientist if he hadn't been the wonderful writer that he was. He wrote right from the beginning. He was a writer. At the age of 16, he published his first scientific article, and he published probably 3 or 4 articles almost every year after that. Many of them we haven't even discovered. Some of them are unsigned articles in newspapers, and we haven't even scratched that surface. But he was somebody who knew he knew things and knew it was useful and didn't want to just sit on it. He wanted it to be useful to the citizens that he was really writing for. He wasn't writing so much for scientists, but for citizens.
Education was a strong cause of his. He felt painfully the lack of a college education on his own part. So when he came to Milwaukee, he was always lobbying or or pushing for better education. He was a founder of the Milwaukee Female Seminary, which became Downer College. He donated land for the first high school in Milwaukee. He organized classes to meet at the Unitarian Church, and he lectured on science and geology for these repeatedly. He was just all for the advancement of knowledge, and we think that too comes from his Quaker background and his sense of public service.
You know, he was so accomplished in so many areas, different fields of study. At what point in our history did we lose that kind of person?
Right at the time of his life. He was aware that he was a generalist and he had the blank slate of Wisconsin to work in, but he realized that some of the sciences had become so vast in data and knowledge that only that specialists were going to be required. So when he was appointed state geologist, instead of making the assistant geologist some of his all-around cronies in all sciences, he chose only college-trained young men to be the assistant state geologist. And that was an enormous contribution to the effort, and they produced a masterpiece of a state geological survey.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think a person like him could exist today, or would he be made to focus on one specialty? Probably, you know, is there room for a generalist?
I think we're all generalists now because of him. The kind of science he did is the stuff that we learned in schools, and we've all taken the Lapham view of relating the various sciences. That's for the public to do. The specialists are still out there, and they're absolutely essential in carrying forward science as it becomes more sophisticated. But the public foundation of science is basically what Lapham knew, and he was the first to establish it in Wisconsin and gave us a great foundation.
Yeah. I was trying to think of anyone today that reminds me of Increase Lapham and his passion for a wide range of scientific study. I haven't come up with anybody.
We have neither.
To be perfectly honest. What do you think is his most lasting legacy?
I think one of his legacies, one of his important legacies, is the idea of citizenship. Is what makes a good citizen? Well, I don't know if it lasted, but I hope it would last. Mm-hmm. Is he saw that every citizen had a responsibility to preserve history and to keep the history of a community. And he wrote about this very movingly when he was involved in the founding of the Wisconsin Historical Society. And he thought that a Wisconsin citizen should be one who knew his community, knew its roots, and knew its springs. And this was one of his legacies. Another, and the more specific one, is his Antiquities of Wisconsin, which is the great work, one of the great works of his life. And we've talked about the National Weather Service. That was certainly one of his, you know, that came in large part as a result of his endeavors. So, you know, it's hard to sort of narrow it down. But
in the 1860s, he was part of a three-man forestry commission that produced a report which we're sure he was the author of, that warned of the damage that would be done to Wisconsin with the continued deforestation of the northern pinery. It's an astonishing piece of early environmental and ecological writing, preceding Aldo Leopold and John Muir by decades. And it's still a very important book. He understood that, for example, in that book, he understood that forests were a sustainable source of energy, whereas coal and oil and gas were to be used once and never again, and would was a limited supply. So here in the in 1869, you get an idea that that our energy supplies that we rely on in the 20th century are temporary and diminishing, whereas good protection and good stewardship of the surface of the earth would provide us with energy indefinitely.
And he also, in a very in that very early date, described the climatic effects of the destruction of the forests, the effects on the watersheds, on the temperature of the land, on the air quality.
You, an amazing guy. Alice emailed me and wondered. She said, "I'm delighted to hear the two authors talk about their fascinating subject. Will this wonderful history book about Increase Lapham be made available in an audio format?"
We don't know.
not our department.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It would be nice.
It would be great. It would be a great reading book, I think.
I think you're right. I think it would be a wonderful reading as well. I'm hoping, and again, the Wisconsin Historical Society published your book, right?
Yes.
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 And I hope sales are doing well.
Oh, we do too. We think they are.
We think they're robust.
Yeah.
I'm really pleased to have this opportunity to talk with you. You really, it's a lively book about a lively guy. That's for
sure. Thank you.
That's great praise.
Yeah.
It makes for wonderful reading, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Larry.
Our pleasure, Larry.
Oh,
thank you.
Well, thank you both so, so much. Talking with the co-authors of the book, I have it right in front of me, Studying Wisconsin, The Life of Increase Lapham, early chronicler of plants, rocks, rivers, mounds, and all things Wisconsin. What an amazing guy. And you're going to learn a lot about him in reading this book. I hope this book finds its way into our school system too, because it would be great. It covers so many different areas. It could be used as a reference in a lot of different subject areas. Our guests, Martha Berglund and Paul Hayes. Martha, she is co-author of Studying Wisconsin. Paul Hayes, the other author. Paul worked for the Milwaukee Journal for many, many years. And Martha, she was actually took a break from fiction to write an article for Milwaukee Magazine about him, and wound up spending 5 years studying Increase Lapham. And I think she did it because he is such an interesting character. Well, coming up, I hope you'll stay tuned, because we will be talking with Jay Thurston. Jay knows more about trout and trout fishing than anybody I know. And he's got a new book out, and it's a wonderful read. It's called Spring Creek Reward, Jay Ford Thurston. Our guest next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.